If you'd like to leave your thoughts on this interview or ask our gurus a question, visit softwaresecuritygurus.com or leave us a voice message by visiting anchor.fm/softwaresecuritygurus.
Welcome to the Software Security Gurus webcast. My name is Matthias Mandu, CTO and co-founder of Secure Code Warrior. And with me today, I have Julie Tsai. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you, Matthias. Thank you for having me here.
Fantastic to be on the show. Julie, do you mind sharing a few words about yourself?
Not at all. So I am head of security for Roblox, and I have been working in for 20 years. My core specialties before I went into management were in DevOps and configuration management, which led me naturally into security. I was a system administrator for 13 years, and now, you know, glad to be part of the larger security community.
Excellent. Excellent. So great. So for today, I have three topics in mind. And the first one is I saw you on a Forrester talk, which really sparked my interest because you were talking about structure within an organization and the relations within that structure. And you talked about a tech chief, a risk chief, security. And essentially what you were advocating for is if you have the structure right and it has to be simple, so many things go easy. Can you shed a little bit of a light on how you see structure?
Yeah, absolutely. I see structure somewhat as the mechanics or the machinery behind the people and the culture. And it's kind of the skeleton of like how we're encouraging the people to grow, how to be incentivized, where to expedite alignments, and where to find healthy constructive tension. So I think it really is a good an important thing to do, whether you're at the beginning stage of starting your startup or, you know, you're evolving the company to that next level of the larger stage, you know, has to keep evaluating whether or not the structural scaffolding that you set up for the company is encouraging the right behaviors and alignments across the board. Security, I think, is a particularly fascinating and interesting area because I often like to tell people in our teams it's a full brain, full person exercise. There's the technical aspects of it, which are infinitely deep and very broad. But then there's also the human component, which is at least as important in terms of people's experience, their appetite for risk and fear, and any kinds of, you know, cultural experiences they may be bringing in from other companies. So when you're thinking about how to make things go efficiently, you want things to be lined up in places where, you know, certain things will get fast-tracked, certain voices will get prioritized. And as the company changes, those things will change as well.
Yeah, and I think that rapidly changes, right? If you go from a startup to a scale-up to, I'm not sure if you're a scale-up or you're a full-blown company. With the structure that you have right now, what are like the latest changes that you've done that you said, well, you know what, that's something that I'm very happy with. And that helps, again, drive the things forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that's an opportunity when you're in a, once the company has decided that, okay, security is its own named function, and there's going to be a leader at the top who's representing and absorbing the responsibility for that. It's effectively matrixed because usually in an earlier stage of company, you'll have all the individual departments responsible for their own security and reliability and delivery. It's all bundled up in one package. And my earliest security roles were like that. Well, just as a matter of fact, of, you know, running infrastructure, running technical operations, you are also responsible for the security and compliance that goes with it. And that goes all right for a while. But once the company has decided to name it out, now what you're actually responsible for is influencing behaviors across departments that you most events do not directly control. So the whole principle behind winning friends and influencing people becomes very, very important, as well as what are the structural incentives that can be set up. I think once you're in a matrixed role where you do need to influence across the org and get things to point in a certain direction, And it's important to line up both the soft and hard lines of partnership. And this can take a couple of different forms. In the industry, it's very popular, and not just popular, effective to have like some version of like a champions or an ambassadors program across the org. Usually a lot of people in the company, even if they don't work inside security, will find security interesting or fascinating, or someday may stumble upon a crisis. And so giving them the tools with which to analyze and handle it is only helpful to them and the company in terms of, hey, this is how you think about it. This is how you think about risk. This is where you need to, you know, push it all the way to the top, or push it broadly across to your major leaders to make a quick decision on. And these are areas where maybe sometimes it's less escalated. So there's different things that can do. The other piece that's really, really important is that once a company gets to a certain size, it's impossible for any one department or one executive to know everything on an extremely granular level of what's happening. You need eyes and ears throughout the company, and friendly ones. So they're in a position to understand what's happening in their teams much better than you do. They understand their tech stack, and they understand, you know, what's possible and what's not possible. So it's essential that you get that partnership across the board in terms of, hey, you know, the thing that you're thinking in terms of the ideal may not work, but here's something that will. You know, this is a different way to limit the risk, you know, and these are some other options here. And so this is where I think the art comes in, of really understanding your company and the culture and the people there, because you start out with we all start out with an ideal of what we want it to look like. But then the reality, when you come into different companies and their different strengths and weaknesses, you must tailor it for the situation.
That matrix structure that you're talking about, is that something that comes if you're moving from reactive to proactive? Because initially everything is just firefighting, because it's not the first thing on your mind when you're a startup or when you're a scale up. But once you get out of that firefighting mode and you go to more of a proactive, does it have anything to do with that or not at all?
I think the shift from reactive to proactive is first and foremost a function of resourcing. I think that when you don't have, when you either historically haven't spent time on the area or don't have the people, then it will be a much more reactive function where you're just going from fire to fire. There's a lot of fires, including ones that you may not even know about until it becomes very severe. And then once you get more people, you can start driving the discussions further up the chain. The good positive part about fires is they're very obvious. It's not an abstract question of what's the problem. There's clearly a problem. It's threatening the business. People can see it. It's very tangible. You know, the problem, of course, is the damage is happening, and the chance to have averted it is gone. So as you have more people to both work the problems and to partner across the org, now you can start driving slightly more proactive discussions. You can start talking about, you know, I think about it almost in a physics way, like of actual exploitation versus potential exploitation. Now we can move it to a place like, this might happen. We do have a vulnerability. We do have a vulnerability report. We've done the analysis. We've done the deep dives, and like these are things that can happen. So you start to have more work around the potentials of what can happen. There's sometimes a lot of robust debate that's healthy there, because people sometimes are going to challenge the risks in a healthy way and say, "Hey, I'm not sure if I think it's like that much of a problem. We've gone along this long without it being an issue." And that's one of the, I think, the biggest evolutions for a company and for humans, is this maturing of the capability to see what might happen and what they can proactively do. Because there is definitely a tendency for people to normalize risk, right? Mm-hmm. I've been going along for so long that I think it's okay, right? But as you go along, sometimes you don't realize that the terrain has changed. I think COVID being a great example, geopolitical problems, you know, some of the things we've seen in terms of major exploit rings and that kind of thing. Some of those things can change on the outside, but then at the same time, things are changing on the inside also. Your company is changing. You're getting different people, more people. Maybe you're releasing more products and you have more attack surface. Maybe you're now more public, so you're more of a target. So I think that, you know, security, just like any other endeavor in tech, is fast changing and evolving. And it's always good to stay on your toes in terms of, if I look at where, if I feel where we are right now and measure where we are right now, both internally and externally, are we different than we were a year ago or a month ago?
Perfect segue into my second subject, which is measurement. And you already touched on it. But so with that, it's even more difficult than I thought it was, because now you're talking about an ever evolving landscape internally, externally. You have to measure that. So you have to constantly adopt. How do you do that? Where do you start with measurement? How do you quantify security risk ultimately?
Start simple. Start with one or two things. And it's a deceptively simple approach, right? Because actually to simplify a complex thing is the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. But usually what we'll start looking at is, okay, what's within our capability to measure today and with the instrumentation we have today? If I don't have a lot of tooling or automation, I'll start with some manual metrics and say, okay, you know, how many investigations are we having to do? How many different incidents are coming up? How many were proactive versus reactive, like incidents versus vulnerabilities? What are things that we can start pushing that conversation more upstream proactively so that you're actually getting the problem at the root? But like each of these things starts to become a example that has to become a valuable teaching moment. You know, there's ways of analyzing things where you have a comprehensive, exhaustive amount of information. And in early stages, you don't have that, either the luxury or burden of that. In that case, what you have to do is take the telling incident or the telling detail and expand and infer from there in a very disciplined way so that people understand that it's not FUD, it's not fear and doubt, but to know that, hey, you know, based on... Probably the best example I can think of in recent times is the positivity rate that we measure for COVID, right? There's an assumption right now that, hey, there's stuff going on. We don't have full visibility. We won't get full visibility. But based on a certain metric that we can get, the sample size that I have, I'm going to infer beyond that to say that, like, I believe that the general population is reflecting what I see in a much smaller sample.
Okay. And so do you have a dashboard you regularly look at in terms of measurement, or do you rely on these samples that you, make bigger? Or
sure. Yeah. With dashboards, right? The problem is there's so many of them, right? So yeah, once you get past that initial flush of, needing to start to measure, if you have a motivated team and, good technologists, very rapidly, you will have the opposite problem of too many, too many views and dashboards. So I think that like getting it back to those, principled questions, those original ideas in the beginning, what were we trying to solve for? What are we trying to measure? If I had to take a one or two fact indicator of like where we are, what would it be? Now we can expand on that, especially for teams that are doing the deep dive. But I think especially in terms of the broader communications people who are outside of the security department and like above and beyond, it's really important to take a couple of simple things and just to consistently show a pattern. So that there's time for people to absorb and internalize it.
That was exactly what I was going to ask. Like, what do you show, for example, to the board? What do you show upwards? Because there's so many things that are measured these days. What are like key metrics that you think they should be aware of?
Sure. I always start number one with incidents, right? In terms of the number of security incidents that we're seeing, the type of insecure security incidents, the genre of stuff that we're seeing, and the impact levels. Because I like to start with empirical things, but also you are needing to, from an impact level, you're looking at something that actually is or did happen to the company. So like just start there. And it speaks to the common understanding around monitoring, and around, is it going to take down the business? Is it taking down our trust levels? Is it, are we compromising volumes of data? So start with the thing that is most obvious and most important, the incidents. From there, I think it's equally important to talk about coverage level. So this is something that's talked about in some metrics, some metrics methodologies as I think specific coverage metric or that visibility, but it is, if I'm getting let's suppose I'm seeing some sort of 5% failure rate on an issue, right? Let's suppose I'm seeing attacks, successful attacks on a particular system 5% of the time over a month. However, if I'm only covering or have a visibility into 10% of my total area, my unknown unknowns are actually the much greater risk.
Yes.
So it's important, I think, to focus the lens of the conversation around where are the big risks. And I think in a lot of companies, as you're growing and evolving, the unknown unknowns will usually be more than 50%. Now, a more mature entity and like more resourced, it should be lower, much lower than that. But they also can have their pockets of, lack of visibility, usually because of complexity. So I think that it's always good to go back to that question of like, okay, this is what I'm seeing in terms of like issues that are coming up. How much am I actually seeing? How well are we actually seeing it? Rather than getting too detailed about the smaller metric, make sure that like we have a good understanding of like our visibility coverage area. And then from there, of course, every board is going to want to understand like how we're doing on our vulnerability remediations and patching and like the fundamentals. You know, there's a reason that these things keep coming back.
The unknowns is very interesting for me. If we talk to organizations, some basic stuff, how many developers do you have? How many applications do they have? It's very exactly. Interesting, right? And then the larger the organization, the harder it gets to get all that information together.
It totally does.
So we went from the organizational structure to measuring. Let's go one level deeper. Let's go to DevOps and DevSecOps. Let's use a buzzword. But hey, how is that evolving? How do you see that evolving? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think of it in terms of, I first encountered the term when coming out of it out of the configuration management and self-healing systems sort of school of thought. And so when it first emerged, I was wondering how would we still find definition between people's expertises and roles. I have a belief that it takes, it's that axiom about 10,000 hours or 10 years to become, to achieve mastery in different areas. I believe this is true for both development as well as systems individually. And, and so at the time I wonder, okay, how are we going to maintain that, like understanding the specialization? But as time evolved, I saw that like, almost every company that I would work at, I've worked at a lot of startups, you would end up with like this almost predictable sort of, battle, sometimes friendly, sometimes not so friendly between these camps. And it became clear like, well, clearly something has to evolve here in terms of the conversation. It's tiring to have the same conversation every time going into each place and who's going to deploy and who's going to control like these changes and what layer of the stack people own. It's like, it happens repeatedly. So I think that the really important thing it did is it made a really painful part of, this part of the dynamic visible and understandable and created friendships and relationships across a wide array of technical specializations. Over time, I think that my understanding of how DevOps is and should work is that you've built out your automation from the beginning part of the way that you image, the way that you manage configuration through build and deployment in such an articulated and precise way that you have the accountability you need in terms of, there are always another pair of eyes or another team that's able to review something, a change that's going out, that things are happening very quickly because it's predictable and consistent and automated. And you have very, very good hooks in terms of being able to roll back. This is my ideal, perfect picture of how this should flow. What seemed to evolve over time in the business is these jokes that we would have about like DevOps as no ops, or this is just where you give the keys to, you give root to the developers and just call it a day. It's like, well, no, that was a joke. But, we've gotten to the stage where like, I think we have to we end up having to iterate a little bit about, how it manifests in your particular organization. What I definitely see coming into different companies is that there's pockets automation and pockets where it just either wasn't done or there's other kinds of shortcuts that are being done. And so I think being able to deepen that understanding of, hey, we want to get to, you know, automation and empowerment across the entire eng org. We want to get to precision, but there's a couple of work steps that need to happen in order to get to that place. We can't just achieve this nirvana freedom without having done the work beforehand and then understand that there's a lot of value to have at the end. Now, not coincidentally, this ends up being awesome for security because you have really precise change. You have really precise configuration management. Things are logged. You know when things have gone in and out, and you have total accountability on the users and authorizations. And that principle should flow throughout, even as like we're evolving into more widespread microservices platforms and APIs, same principles about like having, very specific authorization between different kinds of services and calls, very specific ways of when you're going to allow a function or not. So I think that that's part of how this needs to evolve, but part of what we see is that there's a natural evolution of the thinking around these things between kind of lumping together all the functions mm-hmm. and then splitting them apart, you know? And so I think that we're at a particular phase where there's a lot of things, a lot of tools in the ecosystem that have come together to try to abstract and connect all these things, especially in the virtualization and the container space and all of that to make it more seamless. And yet we've also built on more complexity. Mm-hmm. And so I think that probably what needs to happen next is some way of simplifying how to truly embody those principles of, you know, really well understood change control, really well understood configuration and image expression, even within this complex tool environment that we now have. I don't have an easy answer for that.
No, so I actually would like to go a little bit deeper on the security side. And what I quite often see, and tell me if that's a similar thing that you see, they try to go the DevOps way and they're on its way of doing it and they're progressing, but they quickly throw into security into the mix and then it's, you know, it's all over yes. the place. It doesn't work. They threw it in like too fast.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And so I think this is where security can help drive DevOps, in my opinion, back to its true meaning, as opposed to this idea of, creating kind of a mishmash or sort of a free-for-all. It's like, hey, actually, we need to be able to know, we need to be able to have departments be able to do good code and change reviews. We need to have some predictability on these things. We need to have a good organization of different repository structures and code structures and that kind of thing. And so I think that like some of the needs that you get on the security and compliance side where people may have had a temptation to defer deeper architectural work or deeper like design work, it becomes a forcing function for better or for worse in terms of like, okay, now you actually have to prove separation of duties for SACs. And now you actually have to show change management and predictable vulnerability management for these different compliance needs. But I don't think that it's at odds. It doesn't need to be at odds with agility. I think it comes mm-hmm. back to trying to create your pipelines and workflows in a way that you may have to go a little bit slower to build in the right controls and the right design, but going slower to go faster. Yeah. Ultimately. So my hope is that security and compliance can help drive back some of the more what I think the true original meaning of DevOps is, as opposed to this idea of everyone has access to everything or that everyone can be, you know, both the most senior developer and the most senior operator at the same time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Maybe one final question. You're at Roblox. And so back in the day when I was a kid, and I know you're a mom, when I was a kid yeah. and somebody's dad was, for example, a firefighter, we're like, oh, wow, his dad is a firefighter. You're working at Roblox if your daughter yeah. goes to school. Are you like the popular mom that's like, well, her mom works at Roblox. Is it like that?
Well, you know what? We get a lot of like now, right now with shelter in place, like we don't get the same gratification of seeing everybody to do that. But I will say that it is a big hit with, I got to sit in on a presentation we did for an elementary school class, and it totally felt like being a virtual rock star because the kids were just blowing up the Zoom chat with questions and there were so many, they were so engaged. Or, you know, every once in a while I'll be busy with something and you know, my daughter will want to do something. I say, no, I'm working. She's like, oh no, you have to protect Roblox. It's for the kids. And she's like, you know, she's like, I just love it so much. And it, you know, I want to help do it someday. So I was like, okay, this is great.
Nice. Does your daughter get more screen time because you work at Roblox?
You know, I think inadvertently she does because she sees what we're doing all day and then she's doing stuff. But, you know, we definitely try to keep it engaging. Like I just showed her, you know, the way that, you know, people can, that you can use Roblox Studio to build games. And she was just so mm-hmm. excited. Like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, I can build my own game. Exactly.
Nice. All right, Julie, thank you very, very much for coming on to the webcast. Really appreciate the chat. It was a fantastic chat.
Same here. Thank you, Matthias.
Thank you.
Software Security Gurus is sponsored by Secure Code Warrior, the secure coding company.